Today's episode is brought to you by Supplements Made Simple, evidence-based supplements formulated by me, ensuring that you and your family get a meaningful health benefit from your daily supplement routine. Supplements Made Simple is available in pharmacies nationwide or online at mars.ie. Welcome to today's episode. I'm very excited to introduce Dr. Mick Crotty, GP specialising in the treatment of obesity at My Best Weight. And you can follow Dr. Mick and colleagues on Instagram, and it's at My Best Weight. So thanks, Mick, for travelling to Cork to chat to me today. It's so nice to meet you in person.
Not at all. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here and have these conversations.
Yeah. So we've been chatting a lot. So now we need to record because it's been so insightful already just speaking to you in the last few minutes. Okay. So let's start at the beginning. So can you just explain what is obesity? What causes it?
So our thinking now is that obesity is not an issue with willpower. It's not a lack of motivation. This is actually a complex, progressive, chronic disease. We define obesity these days not by size, not by body mass index, but by excess or atypical fatty tissue that impairs health. And that second part is actually the most important thing. This is not about how big somebody is. It's not about their size. This is about if somebody's health is being affected, then they have a medical issue. And kind of, I think about health as our psychological health and well-being, our physical, mechanical, functional health, or our metabolic health. So if somebody is living with excess weight and it's affecting any of those areas of health, then potentially they have the chronic disease of obesity. So obesity is not a lack of personal responsibility. It's not a lack of knowledge about nutrition. It's actually more complicated. And if we go into kind of the causes of obesity, that's the thing I think that is misunderstood in society. There's this idea that, you know, people who are living with excess weight, who are living in a bigger body, that they don't have willpower, that they are kind of eating rubbish food and not exercising. And that's not the case. If we look at the causes of obesity, we know genetics plays a major role. That somewhere between about 40 and 70% of our risk of whether we're going to have an issue with weight over the course of our life is genetically conferred. If we look at the genes that have been identified, and there's hundreds of them identified at this stage, and how they affect our body, about 80% of the genes that are associated with weight code for what's going on in our subconscious brain. So our subconscious brain, an area called the hypothalamus, and another area that's adjacent called the limbic system, that's where our energy balance, that's where our hunger, our fullness, and our craving, reward, and desire for food is regulated. And in those of us who are more predisposed to weight issues, we have a dysregulation of appetite, and we often have a hyperactivity of the reward pathways in that area of our brain. So because of that, because of our neurochemistry, we are often driven to take in more than our body needs. And that's the real crux of it, is if we take in more than our body requires, we will have an issue with weight, but it's not because of willpower, lack of knowledge, or lack of intelligence.
Yes. So that you were saying that it's not, we don't, you know, assess for obesity or overweight by, you know, BMI or the size of a person. So, you know, when a patient presents to you at clinic and you're making that initial assessment, how do you actually do that at clinic?
So I suppose it's easy for me in my specialised clinic because people come to me kind of, you know, seeking treatment. So that person has identified themselves that weight is having an impact on their life and on their health. So it's easy for me when they come because they're open to talking about weight, they want to talk about weight, and they want to look into different treatment options that might be open to them. And oftentimes there's an exploration of, you know, how their weight is where it is and what issues they struggle with day to day and how it is impacting their life. Because that's really the most important thing. It's each individual person. It's their journey. It's what's their experience. You know, and I think we often, you know, when we think about health and weight, we often think about blood pressure and cholesterol and diabetes and kind of metabolic health. But we often ignore the kind of practical physical issues day to day, the ability to walk into a shop and find clothes that fit us, the ability to not be nervous about going different places because of breathlessness or because of the seating that might be available, the ability to keep up with our friends, not have back pain or knee pain, and even the psychological side. Many people that I meet, you know, from the moment they get up in the morning to the moment they go to bed at night, they're trying not to eat. It's not that they're excessively hungry. It's not that they're not satisfied by food, really, or they have cravings. It's that all day is spent in some way thinking about food and trying not to eat because they're trying to manage their weight. And this is a challenge, you know, lifelong for many people.
Yes.
And the brain space, the amount of effort,
yeah,
and the amount of frustration that people have because they're doing this and they're doing what they're being told to do.
Mm.
You know, for how many years now have we been telling people eat less, move more, diet, exercise? That's the solution.
Yeah.
And really, it's not.
Yeah.
You know, that is not a treatment for the chronic disease of obesity. Regardless of our size, we should all be focusing on healthy eating. Regardless of our size, we should all be physically active because those things are going to improve our health.
Yes.
But they're not a treatment for this medical issue. And that's what's missing, is that all of our focus has been on prevention rather than actually treating people who have a medical issue.
Yeah.
And most of my patients, you know, they're well aware of healthy foods.
Yes.
They have very healthy diets and they are as physically active as their body will let them be.
Yes.
But they're still struggling with weight.
Yes.
And that's the frustration. You know, people are smart, they're intelligent, they're aware of nutrition. They're often exceptionally successful in so many areas of life. You know, they've done well in school, they've done well academically, in sports and in their job. And this is an area that they're not able to control.
Mm.
And they're so frustrated by that. But it makes sense because this is biology. You can't control your biology.
Yeah.
I cannot think myself less hungry. I can't think myself more full because this is my subconscious brain. This is hormones. This is neurochemistry. That would be like me trying to think myself hotter or colder.
Yeah.
I can't do that.
Yes.
So I think that's the frustration, is that we're told with hard work, with effort, with willpower, you'll be able to solve this.
Mm.
And the frustration is people can't.
Yeah.
And really what I see every day is most people I meet, they haven't had an issue with losing weight over the course of their life. They have repeatedly lost weight and vast amounts of weight. The problem is that weight comes back.
Mm.
So it's this kind of frustration of constantly losing weight and the weight comes back.
Mm.
And really, for me, it's kind of sharing an understanding with people of the kind of physiological or biological reasons why that happens. And that helps us understand why dieting long term isn't the solution for most people.
Yeah. So fascinating. And as you said, so many important points that you've made there, Mick. And one of them, you know, that, you know, we all know, you know, what healthy eating is. Like everyone knows it. Everyone knows, you know, the more vegetables and the move more and, you know, so people know this, you know, so it's not just as simple as, you know, informing or just continually repeating that message to people. The other point as well that I just wanted to kind of explore with you a little bit is because I see a lot in medicine in recent, I suppose, years, is that now amongst a lot of doctors, the messaging is that obesity is a chronic disease that we manage. But then I listen to like other groups and other viewpoints, and they don't accept this, I suppose, you know, characterizing being in a bigger body as being in a disease state. Mm. So there is that kind of difference of opinion there. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's always good to have different perspectives on things. And I've learned more from talking to people. I've learned more from talking to my patients than from any book out there. And we're all unique. We're all different. Our genetics are unique. Our experiences are unique. And the things we struggle with day to day are unique. So there has been this argument that you're just, you know, pathologizing or pathologicalizing or whatever the word is, you know, size, or you're just medicalizing this and trying to, you know, this is just big pharma trying to sell medications.
Yes, yes, yes.
And really, to me, it comes back to that definition we talked about, you know, excess or atypical fatty tissue or adiposity that impairs health.
Mm.
If there's an impairment of somebody's health, and they will tell me if there's impairment of health, then it's a medical issue. If there isn't impairment of health, if somebody is living in a bigger body and they don't have an impairment of health, you know, that person doesn't have the chronic disease of obesity.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm not, as a specialist in this area, I'm not walking down the street tapping people on the shoulder saying, listen, come here, you know, I want to talk to you about your weight.
Yeah.
You know, that's not appropriate.
Yeah.
So this is for people who've got a medical issue, as I said, psychological, physical or metabolic as a result of weight and treating it.
Yeah.
And really, you know, if we are treating it, if we're doing it, you know, based on the science, we're not blaming and shaming people. We are not telling them to eat less and move more. We are treating them as an individual and we're putting them at the center. So when I talk to people, I talk about different treatment options and they tell me what will be the best for them because I have no concept what people are dealing with day to day. So my role is to convey information, to tell people about the pros and cons and then for them to tell me what route they want to take.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that often gets kind of confused in society is there is absolutely a movement against diet culture.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea that, you know, we shouldn't be focusing solely on weight, we shouldn't be pushing kind of dieting on people and kind of weight loss on people. And, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, we live in a very thin-centric society, that everything, the messaging from when we're very young is thin is beautiful and you should be thin. And if you're not thin, you know, you are lazy or gluttonous or all these negative connotations. And in studies, they have shown that, you know, there are assumptions made about people based on their weight. Yeah. There's assumptions made about their lifestyle. There's assumptions made about their physical activity, about their diet, about their intelligence,
about their
health and about their productivity. And, you know, in studies, it's been shown, you know, people who are living with obesity, they, you know, score lower on tests, you know, subjective tests, because, you know, again, they are judged based on their weight. So that is absolutely wrong. Weight stigma, weight bias, blaming and shaming people, the misunderstanding that this is willpower, the misunderstanding that simply eating less and moving more is not helpful. Denying people medical treatment based on size or weight, that's not allowed. You can't discriminate against people based on weight, because that's unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
But yet it still happens hugely in society. So for me, absolutely, we need to balk against diet culture and stigmatizing people. But there's a difference between turning away from diet culture or getting rid of that, but also offering treatment to people who've got a medical issue. These are, you know, you can do both.
Yes.
So it shouldn't be a case that we're saying, can, you know, diet culture is bad, but, you know, not offering treatment.
Yeah.
So I think these are separate kind of issues.
They're, to me anyway, definitely two separate things entirely. I mean, I follow your page and I have listened to you speak on webinars. I never, ever feel like I'm being immersed in diet culture ever when I consume anything that you put out there. Diet culture to me isn't something different entirely. So they really are two very separate things. And I never feel like I'm being exposed to diet culture ever when I'm listening to you or looking at my best weight. So, okay, so then everyone's talking about the weight loss injections.
Mm.
So what are they? What are the main ones?
Yeah, so I suppose this is a big thing in recent years that, you know, previously, traditionally, we could talk about weight and we could talk about kind of treatment, but we didn't have much to offer people.
Mm.
We had maybe surgical treatments, which were very restricted. We had behavioral treatments, nutritional treatments, which, again, were helpful for many people, but, you know, didn't work for everybody. And treatment is different for everybody. So now we have medications. We have medications that are safe, that are effective for people. And those medications are kind of really interesting in how they work, because really they are treating the underlying biology. They are targeting the dysregulation of appetite in our subconscious brain.
Mm-hmm.
So there are three different medications that are licensed in Ireland for obesity, the chronic disease of obesity. There is an older medication called Orlistat or Xenical, and that's the devil. It is the most horrible stuff. It's been around for donkey's years.
Yeah.
Many people have tried it. It doesn't do anything for our subconscious brain. It purely stops us absorbing fat.
Yeah.
And the side effects are horrendous and nobody stays on it long term.
Yeah.
So I'm going to park that one. But the other two medications we have a tablet medication called Mycimba, and that works to reduce hunger and reduce craving in our subconscious brain. So we are kind of blocking some of the opiate receptors in the brain, and we're having an effect on the hunger centers in the brain, so that so people are less driven towards food. And that will be a very helpful for medication for many people. The challenge is it's a tablet people take every day, and people have to take up to four tablets every day. So doing that long term can be challenging.
Yeah.
I suppose the most exciting medication that has kind of emerged in recent years is a medication we've had for diabetes for probably 15, 20 years. And most doctors and many people living with diabetes will be aware of these medications.
Yeah.
They're called GLP-1 medication. So GLP-1, glucagon-like peptide 1. So essentially GLP-1 is a fullness or satiety hormone that we all have in our body. When I eat, my small bowel produces this hormone, which communicates with my brain to tell me I'm full.
Mm.
Many studies have shown that in the dysregulation of appetite that many people are living with when they have obesity, we don't have enough of this fullness hormone. So we don't get the same fullness response from food. in addition to the excessive kind of hunger hormones that we have that are making us more hungry. So if I have genetic predisposition, one of the things that happens is my hunger hormones are higher than my body needs and my fullness hormones are lower than my body needs. Mm. And I have that hyperactive reward pathway based on my genetics. And then over time, with stress or a medication or a mental health issue or being exposed to chemicals in our environment or trauma or, you know, many different factors over the course of our life, particularly dieting. Actually, dieting, every time we diet, the levels of these hormones change to try and protect us and stop us losing weight. So this is a kind of a fluid system. So these hormones are changing in our brain. So what they did was they isolated this hormone and they made a medication that acts like it. So when people take this medication, it communicates with my subconscious brain to make me feel fuller, quicker, and for longer.
Mm.
And that's the main effect. People come back to me on these medications and they say, you know, for the first time in my life, I know what it feels like to feel full.
Yeah.
Is this how other people feel without a medication?
Yeah.
And essentially that is. Somebody who doesn't have obesity, they get naturally this effect because they have plenty of this fullness hormone and they don't have as much of the hunger hormones.
Yeah.
So that's the way they normally go through life. And that's why they, over the course of life, maybe take in less, is because they're less biologically driven.
Yeah.
So somebody with obesity, when they take this medication, they can feel fuller, quicker, more satisfied. It also has an effect on the reward pathways to reduce the craving, the wanting, the non-hunger and fullness related kind of drive towards food. So that, you know, I'm standing at the fridge, it's 10 o'clock at night, I'm not hungry, but I want something, I need it. So that kind of craving, it has an effect to turn that down. And I suppose I'm a fairly thick, simple person. And the way I kind of imagine it is in my subconscious brain, I've got this caveman and he's roaring and shouting and he is hungry and he is not satisfied and he craves stuff. And my caveman is louder than the guy next to me. So I'm more at risk of taking in more than my body needs. And it's not that I'm eating too much all day, every day. It might be I might be taking 2% or 5% more than I need today or tomorrow.
Yeah.
Or maybe actually all day I'm fine, but then evening times are higher risk. Or maybe it's actually with routine and structure during the week I'm okay, but at the weekends things happen.
Yes.
Or maybe at certain times of the year or times of stress I take in more. So it's kind of nuanced. It's not that we're eating rubbish and eating too much of it. And you know, it's not necessarily that we're eating rubbish at all. Like most people that I meet, kind of, they have a very healthy diet. But for various reasons, at times we take in more than we need. And our body, different people's bodies don't need as much.
Yes.
So this medication works on that biology and it really treats the underlying cause for why we're struggling with weight.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, rather than thinking of these medications as weight loss medications, these are anti-obesity medications. They are treating the underlying biology.
Yeah.
As a side effect of treating hunger and fullness hormones and reward in the brain, we're less biologically driven.
Yeah.
So it should be that without effort, passively, our body wants less.
Yes.
And that's a very strange concept to patients I talk to.
Yeah.
Because they say, this thing that I have been making an effort for my entire life, you're telling me this will change that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I talk to people every single day and I try and kind of share an understanding of the biology and why they struggle. And we can talk about kind of set point for weight and how our body defends weight. And people are kind of, they're kind of taking it in and they're accepting and they're skeptical because, again, people have been burned so many times with kind of, you know, this is the cure and this is it. So kind of they're skeptical. The thing I'm increasingly seeing is when people go on treatment, that's when they realize that this is a biological issue.
Yes.
I haven't given them more willpower.
Yeah.
I haven't given them more motivation. Yeah. I often haven't talked to them about the types of food that I think they should take or anything.
Yeah.
We've given them a medication that treats their subconscious brain. And as a side effect of that, they take in less.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, their weight will come down to a variable degree.
Yeah.
So when people go on these medications, kind of weight comes down. We cannot and will not continue to lose weight forever. So eventually, most people are about 9 to 12 months into treatment, their weight will plateau. And that's where the weight is then on that medication. So these kind of GLP-1 medications, and there's different versions available.
Mm-hmm.
The medication that is licensed and indicated to treat excess weight or obesity is called Saxenda, or liraglutide is the generic name. And that's a once a day injectable medication that people take.
Yeah.
There is another medication that technically is licensed in Europe called Semaglutide.
Mm-hmm.
And Semaglutide is a weekly injection.
Mm-hmm.
Semaglutide is licensed under the brand name Wegovy for weight management.
Yeah.
But the problem is we don't have Wegovy in Ireland yet.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't been made available in Europe yet. So although it's licensed and it's kind of indicated, it's physically not available in our pharmacies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, interestingly, so Wegovy or semaglutide, the generic name, we do have semaglutide in Ireland under the brand name Ozempic for the treatment of diabetes.
Yeah.
So Ozempic is licensed and indicated to treat diabetes. Wegovy is licensed and indicated to treat obesity. They are the same thing.
Yes.
So say exact same molecule, but we just don't have the Wegovy yet.
Yes.
So many people living with obesity are prescribed off-label or off-license Ozempic or diabetes medication.
Yeah.
And it's really effective. It's convenient and that it's once a week. And it's actually cheaper than the daily injectable.
Yes.
The big, you know, one of the major issues, and it feeds back into kind of the stigma and bias and old-fashioned thinking about weight, is that these medications are not reimbursed by the drug payment scheme, by the medical card or long-term illness.
Yep.
So absolutely, we can treat your diabetes, we can treat your blood pressure, we can treat your COPD, and your medications will be covered.
Yeah.
But if you want to take a medication for the chronic disease of obesity,
no,
you have to pay for that.
Yeah.
Because really, all you need to do is just eat less, and that's all you need to do.
Yes.
And that's the kind of thinking. So that's the challenge, is that, again, there is further discrimination that people can't access these medications.
Yeah.
So increasingly, even people who are becoming aware of how complex weight is, they're being aware of this is a chronic disease that is affecting their health, they can't access treatment.
Yeah.
You know, and again, you know, if we focus on, you know, other treatments like surgical treatments and the behavioral, nutritional, life treatments, again, they're very challenging to access. And that really is not fair, because, you know, people deserve treatment.
Yes. Yeah, it's completely unfair. And actually, I remember I phone you during the summertime, because I just had a really difficult situation where a patient who really deserved the treatment but could not access it because, and I linked in with you because I was saying, what do I do here? How do I help this person?
And the frustration of that, as a healthcare professional, if we essentially, you know, we have one hand tied behind our back, we have these treatments that can be life changing for people, and yet people are not able to or allowed to kind of take them.
Access them. You know? And I think your analogy of the cave person in the head, you know, it's kind of, you know, kind of screaming and roaring at you. That's definitely the feedback I've gotten from some patients who are on these medicines, you know, that they're not carrying around this stress or this kind of background noise with them all day. Kind of just, you know, they feel like they're just, they feel normal, like the, how they should feel. Or after they've had, you know, their evening meal, they're not having this feeling of needing to go and have, you know, a snack before bedtime and things like that.
Yeah. And I think if we look at kind of response to treatment, so it's kind of interesting, no matter how much I kind of talk to patients, the first thing, they come back, you know, for their follow-up visit and ask them how they're getting on. And the first thing they'll tell me is how much weight they've lost. And I'm kind of saying, okay, like, I'm actually not that bothered by weight. It doesn't change anything I do. Let's just park that. What I want to know is, how has that happened?
Yes.
What has been the difference in how you felt that has facilitated that? Because you can take 100 people and you can starve them all to the same degree and see 100 different changes on the scales.
Yes.
Some people, you know, can eat very little and lose no weight, whereas other people give up kind of, you know, a small bit of food and next thing their weight plummets. And this is the frustration that people have, because we're all different, you know, in how our body absorbs and uses food and energy. So again, you know, weight is kind of one marker of response, but to me, it's not the most important thing. We often focus on other kind of markers of response.
Yeah.
And that for some people can be better sleep, more energy, reduction in pain.
Yeah.
It can be simple things, you know, better medical conditions, their blood pressure, their diabetes blood tests, or their sleep apnea or acid reflux have improved.
Yes.
It can be that their fitness levels increases.
Yeah.
It can be the psychological difference of not kind of having to think and keep our eyes on the road all day long.
Yes.
And again, feeding back to the frustration and the amount of mental space this takes up for people, it's huge.
That's it.
Like every single day, I'm constantly talking to doctors and GPs about why this is actually a really selfish area of medicine. Because I have people coming back to me, and for the first time in their life, they're saying, you know, I feel different.
Yeah.
I realize this is not my fault.
Yes.
You know, they're just flabbergasted because they have beaten themselves up over time that this is something that they're doing wrong.
Yeah.
And now they kind of say, you know, you were right. You know, as my wife tells me, I'm not always right, but I'm rarely wrong. But they tell me, like, I now understand what you've kind of said about the biology and the hormones and our hypothalamic set point and how our body is constantly fighting to get our weight back up.
Yeah.
Because now I feel different.
Yeah.
I hear the words freedom. I hear the words, you know, that I hear that people are not constantly anxious and worried. You know, I've got an event tonight and I don't want to go, you know, because of that. So they're able to live their life.
And
this is not taking up, you know, space in their brain.
Yeah, they're not carrying it around with them all day, every day.
I have patients who, you know, previously, you know, their mood for the day is dictated by what the scale says. And when people are on these treatments, it's really interesting. They often stop checking their weight.
Yes.
Because they feel different. They don't have to worry that their weight is going to fluctuate up or down, because they can feel different. They can feel, you know, that they're not as hungry. They're more satisfied. They have less cravings.
Yeah.
They can just live their life.
Yeah.
You know, those things we've been putting off. I'll do this when I lose weight. I'll do that when I lose weight. They're just doing these things.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, it's a case of, you know, to me, this is no different than any other chronic medical issue.
Yeah.
You know, so as a GP, somebody comes into me with high blood pressure. It's not their fault.
Yep.
You know, they have a genetic predisposition. Yes. It runs in their family.
Yep.
Absolutely. The environment we live in, their stress and their salt and their diet have an impact too. And we talked about salt and we talked about physical activity and stress, and those will help. But many people will still need a blood pressure tablet.
Yes.
And we don't punish them.
Agonize.
We don't give out to them. Yeah. We don't even think about it.
Yes.
We say, here's a blood pressure tablet. This will improve your health. Let's also focus on these other things.
Yeah.
And really, that's the way we're thinking more is if I think about medications or bariatric surgery, they are biological treatments that essentially shut up the caveman in my subconscious brain.
Yeah.
They turn down the volume on my appetite system.
Yes.
So that, you know, the smart guy who's driving the bus isn't being bombarded all day long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my prefrontal cortex, the executive function, the kind of cognitive part of my brain, the modern man that knows about nutrition, that knows about physical activity, that knows kind of the things they want to do, and that person is able to do those things.
Yes.
So these medications treat the biology, and that facilitates changes in behavior.
Yeah.
So it doesn't mean that people still don't have to be engaged on, you know, healthy eating or good food choices. It doesn't mean that they don't have to be engaged on being physically active and managing sleep and stress and kind of, you know, moving away from processed foods and less meat and, you know, more plant-based. Like, all of those things people do.
Yeah.
But, you know, most people that I meet, they know all of that.
And like you said, actually, at the beginning, we all have to do those things. We all have to try to sleep better and move more and eat more plant-based and eat less processed food. That's for everyone anyway. Yeah, you said that at the start. And, you know, this thing as well about kind of the shift and the focus coming away from the weight and the size. I've seen that as well with patients on these medicines. The number on the scales isn't this big thing that they want to tell you about, or they don't really want to tell you about the weight. It's just, you know, I had a patient said that she just wasn't dreading Christmas, you know, and it's kind of more profound and complex, and people kind of, it feels, well, how they describe to me is that they are just feeling like how they normally should, like, God, this is actually how life should be.
Yeah, that word normal, I suppose, is kind of a dangerous word, because what is normal as far as, you know, if I feel normal taking it less, I suppose normal is me and who is normal or what is normal. But I suppose the way they would describe
important
it to me
point.
Is that I feel like somebody else who doesn't have an issue with the weight, who doesn't have the chronic disease of obesity. So essentially, this medical issue they have is now being managed.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it's not like taking an antibiotic where we cure the problem. This requires lifelong treatment.
Yes.
So when somebody takes these medications, whether it's the GLP-1 type medication or kind of one of the other medications, you know, we will see a response. We will treat the biology. As a result of the biology, we take in less. As a result of that, weight comes down. Eventually, it will plateau.
Yes.
We need to continue the medication to maintain that effect.
Yeah.
So no different than if I have asthma and I'm coughing and wheezing and I take inhalers, my asthma will improve.
Yes.
If I stop those inhalers, symptoms come back. If I take a cholesterol tablet, my cholesterol comes down and it's at a lower, healthier level. But if I stop taking the cholesterol tablet, it will go back up again. So again, for the same reason, these medications need to be taken long term to maintain weight. And that's a different way of thinking, but that fits with the idea that we are not curing this, we are managing the symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know that if we stop those medications, in the vast majority of people, weight will come back.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes back to how our body defends weight. And again, within that subconscious part of our brain in the hypothalamus, we have almost like this thermostat or set point or memory for weight that remembers our highest weight. So if I'm, let's say, 20 stone and that's where my weight is, within my brain, that's etched in my brain. So if I, let's say at the moment, I go to a slimming club or I restrict or I do something potentially unhealthy or unsustainable and create a calorie deficit and lose weight, as a result of that, my biology shifts, my physiology changes. So yeah. the hunger hormones I'm already struggling with, they get increased.
Mm-hmm.
The fullness hormones that I already don't have enough of, they get reduced. My metabolism slows down and my body becomes more efficient. So I don't burn off as many calories in the day. The reward pathways get hyperactivated. So I get more craving, more wanting for food. So in fact, in response to losing weight, the pitch becomes more tilted against people. And now in the second half, we're playing uphill against a gale force wind.
Yeah.
So that's why over time people regain weight with, you know, after dieting or exercising.
Yes.
Because the rules of the game change. And most people, our weight goes back up to where it was before. And unfortunately, those mechanisms don't reset.
Yes.
So people often gain some more. So this kind of yo-yoing, kind of I'm losing weight, but I'm regaining and ending up at a higher point. I'm losing weight and regaining and ending up at a higher point. So this is the frustration that people are constantly losing weight and losing huge amounts of weight, doing the most mystifying, horrendous things.
Yeah.
And so that's why I kind of actually, it wrecks my head altogether when you tell me that somebody with obesity doesn't have willpower, motivation. When you see what people are doing to manage their weight, I couldn't do it, what people are doing.
Yes.
The problem is the things we're doing are unsustainable. They're unhealthy. We can't live our life or enjoy our life. So I suppose in my practice and many kind of specialists around the world are talking about this idea of best weight. So our best weight is the weight we will be when we're living our healthiest life that we can sustain long term.
Yes.
It's not necessarily the lowest we could get our weight to, because we could get our weight lower, but we might be miserable and not be able to go anywhere or do anything. But our best weight is where we get the balance between enjoying life, you know, enjoying the valuable things we have in life and experiences, but also prioritizing health long term. And if I focus on behavioral, nutritional, physical activity, sleep and stress and kind of more kind of the life interventions that will help the smart guy keep his eye on the road, that will help a lot of people and our weight will come down and we will reach our best weight. The problem is, again, as soon as we take our eyes off the road, that weight is going to go back up. With the medications and surgery, once we treat people, the weight comes down. It will be at a lower level. If I stop the medication, my weight will go back up. And again, I suppose the other thing would be is I'm a medical doctor, I'm a GP, and I focus mostly on pharmacotherapy or medications and the behavioural medical nutrition therapies. But equally, I would be the first one to say that surgery is an absolutely fantastic treatment for people who are eligible and who want to go down that route. You know, again, it's not for me to tell somebody you need surgery, you should have to have surgery, but it's for me to tell intelligent people, these are your options. What is acceptable to you in your life? And for some people, surgery would be the best treatment. And we know that surgery is not, you know, if we talk about a gastric sleeve or a gastric bypass, these surgeries are not simply giving somebody a smaller stomach. By adjusting the anatomy of our intestinal tract, we are changing the levels of hormones communicating with the brain. We are changing the absorption of certain kind of nutrients and calories. We are changing bile acid composition. We're changing the microbiome. You know, so there are huge changes that happen, and it's not just because of restriction. So again, they are treating again the underlying biology. So I think about medications and surgery being biological treatments that treat my subconscious brain. And I think about behavioral, nutritional and life treatments as helping me kind of prioritize health and make good decisions. And if we use these in combination, then people's health will improve.
You know, just listening to you speak about it, it's so fascinating. It's so multifactorial, you know, it's a biopsychosocial, you know, really at play. And then you mentioned about people, you know, going to like a, you know, a weight loss meeting or a scheme. And what I often see is people, you know, do it in groups or in pairs or with friends or with, you know, a couple. And there's a, there can be, that can be useful as well, you know, that kind of solidarity, but we're all so different. So you see somebody else having a different reaction, that can be very disheartening for another person because everybody's response, you know, would be so different.
Absolutely. I think everybody knows people who could eat and drink what they want and not have an issue with weight. And there's reasons for that. And then, you know,
do they exist?
So I think actually there's some studies looking at that. And you know, there are people who've got very, you know, unhealthy diet who eat kind of very unhealthy foods. But actually, on average, they're not taking in as much as I might take in in a similar situation. So although they're eating unhealthy, they're maybe not taking in as much or maybe kind of not absorbing as much. But again, it's a case of, you know, this is why, like, we are all unique. And and to your point, you know, there is kind of solidarity and there is kind of support when people are going to these meetings. But as humans, then there's also competitive nature.
Yes.
And there's also kind of, you know, people are, you know, starving themselves the day before they go.
Yeah.
And they're kind of, you know, they're making sure I've gone to the toilet before I go down and I won't eat kind of the morning of. Because again, it's all judged on the numbers on the scales.
Yeah.
And again, my mood, my psychological health and well-being is impacted by that.
Yeah.
And again, that's not sustainable.
No.
You know, if no one pattern of eating or diet has ever been shown to be more effective than another long term for managing weight.
Yeah.
You know, again, and people come into me saying, you know, what do you think of keto? What do you think of fasting? And my first question is, you know, do you enjoy it? And can you live the rest of your life like this? Because if that's a pattern of eating that suits you, suits your lifestyle, you enjoy it, then and you can sustain it, then fine.
Yes.
But I just know for most people may have tried keto, they've tried fasting, they've tried paleo, they've tried Dukans and cabbage soup and, you know, any diet you can mention. And yet they have continued to lose weight and regain.
Yeah.
I had a lady come in to me 2 weeks ago who's 86 years of age.
Yeah.
And she told me she's spent the last 65 years of her life dieting.
That's exhausting.
If dieting worked, she would have it figured out at this stage.
Mm.
Like it isn't, it just isn't an effective treatment.
Yeah.
But again, it's kind of, you know, breaking the link between your dieting. And when I talk about dieting, I talk about restriction. I talk about unhealthy, unsustainable patterns of eating and even disordered eating, you know. So that's not sustainable. Healthy eating is what we should focus on.
Yes.
And again, you know, that's for health.
Yeah.
But healthy eating and physical activity as a treatment aren't effective for most people.
Yes.
Or people will lose weight because they're doing, you know, calorie deficit, but that weight will come back because of a shift in our biology.
Yeah. And I mean, these things like, you know, keto, paleo, Dukan diet, you know, as soon as you go out for dinner with friends or, you know, whatever, like that you can't have that rigid way of thinking and put it into like your
absolutely
daily life. It just,
you know,
doesn't work.
Our patterns of eating need to be, you know, flexible.
Yes.
They need to be enjoyable.
Yeah.
They need to be culturally appropriate.
Yeah.
You know, there's no point telling somebody who's vegetarian or vegan, you have to eat meat. Like that's ridiculous. Like that isn't something that's going to work. You know, I can't tell somebody, listen, you need to eat this, that and the other, and they're allergic to this and they don't like that. Like that's not going to work. So any treatment, whether it's, you know, again, behavioral, nutritional, medication or surgery, it needs to fit for somebody in the context of their life.
Yes.
And again, I have, like I said before, I have no concept what people are dealing with day to day and the amazing things people are doing.
Mm.
So, you know, it's not for me to tell somebody this is best for you, that's best. It's about saying, you know, this is available, this is available, this is available. These are the pros and cons.
Yes.
What do you have in yourself?
Yeah.
Because really that to me is the essence. And we're doing it every day in general practice. That's the essence of patient-centered care.
Yeah.
Like the patient needs to be at the center.
Yeah.
And as I said, it's easy for me in my ivory tower kind of clinic where people are coming to see me to talk about weight. You know, when I work in GP, it's infinitely more difficult as a conversation to have because it's such a sensitive area. It's an area that people feel, you know, if I ask about their weight, I'm going to blame them and shame them, give out to them.
Mm.
And it's to bring up these conversations, but to make people aware, this isn't our fault.
Yeah.
This isn't something you're doing wrong. This is a genetically conferred, complex, progressive, neurologically seated chronic disease that is heavily influenced by our environment.
Yes.
Like I said, you know, back in the 80s, we didn't just run out of willpower and motivation. You know, our genetics didn't magically change.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was the environment we live in changed. The types of food that are available, sedentary behaviours, you know, stress and screen time and so many different things in our environment changed. So when I think about the chronic disease of obesity, I think about a genetic predisposition. I think about the hormonal regulation of appetite and reward. And then the environment we live in and our experiences over the course of our life that activate that.
Yeah.
So again, it is absolutely complex. And regardless of how our weight gets to where it gets to, this is the challenge that, you know, if my weight kind of increases because of a medication I was on or because of a trauma or a stress or a pain or genetics or for whatever reason my weight goes up, once my weight is where it is, my brain and my body are now defending that weight.
Yes.
You know, we evolved as humans to survive when food is scarce.
Mm-hmm.
It's not natural to lose weight. We're not supposed to lose weight.
Mm.
You don't see any animals out there, you know, cows, pigs or chickens going on diets. It doesn't happen. If we have adequate food, we're not supposed to lose weight.
Yeah.
No caveman ever went on a diet.
Yeah.
So again, this, you know, that's how our physiology evolved.
Yeah.
To maintain our weight. And that's why in response to weight loss, we get this shift in hormones, shift in metabolism, shift in craving to keep our weight back up.
I mean, there's just so much more at play, you know, than energy in, energy out, and, you know, going to the meetings and, you know, being, you know, weighed publicly in front of other people. You know, I think, you know, a person centered and you know, put yourself at the center of the approach, because I think as well, you know, there's a lot of, you know, people following people online and thinking, well, if that worked for her, you know, but her life is just so different to what.
I think it brings up a really good point as far as kind of you'll often see kind of influencers or different people kind of go, this is what I eat in a day. And it's a case of, okay, well, that's grand for you with your genetics, your neurochemistry, your physiology.
Yes.
But that isn't kind of the way forward. But
yeah.
I think, and we were kind of chatting earlier about this, as far as I am utterly agnostic when it comes to dieting.
Yes.
I don't follow any diet ideology.
Yeah.
Because for me, you know, that is, most diets are not sustainable. If somebody kind of enjoys low carb eating, happy days, crack on with it. You know, there are metabolic benefits to it.
Yeah.
But it isn't kind of long term any better at managing weight.
Yeah.
But these different kind of dietary approaches have almost become like religion, that I'm a keto person, I'm a fasting person. You know, you have these zealots who are kind of, you know, this is how I change my life.
Yeah.
And like I said, there are people out there, now the percentage is small, maybe 10 to 20% of people who maybe can lose weight and keep it off long term with a certain dietary approach. But again, the amount of their life that is occupied by doing that.
Yeah.
So like I said, it's almost replacing religion as a newfound kind of, this defines me, I'm a keto person, that's how I live my life. And again, to your point of how do you go for dinner?
Yeah.
You know, if I'm an intermittent faster or a time-restricted eater, how do I go for lunch with a pal? And I'm sitting there and kind of, I'm drinking a glass of water, or maybe I'm not.
Yeah.
You know, how do you go out? How do you enjoy life? And to me, you know, all we do with people, and the idea of best weight is that, you know, we're facilitating health, we're facilitating living their life, because that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
You know, we're here to enjoy our life. There's value to experience in life, and we're trying to help people with that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And that's the whole crux of it all. It's not about weight. It's not about numbers on the scales or BMI. Yeah. It's about enabling people to improve their health and live their life.
Yeah. Yeah. With people becoming, people are almost radicalized, you know, some of the very extreme examples of people, you know, about being very, you know, radical about, you know, veganism or a plant-based diet and, you know, all of that. But I think I look at it similarly to you, you know, whatever works for that person, you know, in their life day to day. And as well, you know, looking at people online or looking at a friend or a colleague or whatever, and what worked for them. And sometimes I see criticism of saying, oh, well, what resources does that person have? You know, do they have a personal chef that that most people don't have, or do they have time in a gym? But also what I don't see people saying, and what you've said, and it's so interesting, is, but what is her physiology? You know, what is going on in her limbic system that's different, you know, and what is going on with, you know, her hormones or her, you know, her satiety hormones and her physiology, you know.
So, like you wouldn't see somebody who's there, you know, who's kind of saying, this is how I live my life without coughing and wheezing.
Yes.
You know, just because they don't have asthma.
Yeah.
You know, and says, well, every day I get up and I do X, Y, and Z, and that's why I don't cough and wheeze.
Yeah.
Whereas somebody with asthma is kind of saying, well, if I do that, you know, that's not going to treat that chronic disease for me. I need my inhalers.
Yes.
And you'll have some people who will need a blue inhaler once in a blue moon. And you'll have other people who will need two inhalers, a tablet, a nebulizer. They'll still end up on steroids and in hospital.
Yeah.
So it's a spectrum of disease. That's what chronic disease is about.
Yes.
And again, the same is the case with the chronic disease of obesity. Is I have some patients who are bigger people and they might have some impairment of health, but they don't have, you know, they don't all have diabetes or high blood pressure or kind of sleep apnea or the things. And I have patients who on the scales are smaller people and they have every complication.
Yes,
so the
impact
that weight has on our body is variable person to person.
So variable.
And again, I suppose we're more using BMI as a screening tool now to try and identify if somebody might have excess weight and then looking at the impact it has on health.
Yeah.
So as a screening tool, it can be helpful. It's helpful in studies, in population-based studies, at looking at things. But on an individual basis, again, it doesn't take any account of body composition, distribution of weight. There's ethnic kind of differences, people to people. So it is, it's kind of different. And again, as far as kind of the impact that weight has on our health, you know, many people that I see, unfortunately, you know, in the healthcare system, when they present, you know, any and every problem they experience is blamed on weight.
Yeah.
So, you know, in society and in healthcare, weight is seen as the cause of and solution to all the world's problems. And it's not. I'm a doctor who specializes in obesity and specializes in weight. And I'm telling people, you know, that it's not the root of all evil.
Yes.
That, you know, many of my patients are very healthy people.
Yeah.
They have a healthy diet.
Yes.
They're very physically active. They don't have kind of a lot of the metabolic complications.
Yeah.
But they still have obesity and they're living in a bigger body.
Yeah.
Whereas there are many people who kind of, to use that kind of strange word, normal, who are at a normal weight, who are less healthy. So really, I suppose, even if we're talking about health, is what is health? And, you know, it's not about kind of health is not one thing. It's a combination of many things. And, you know, many people I meet are healthy, you know, with obesity, but they can be healthier if we manage their weight.
Yes.
So it's a spectrum.
Yeah, yeah. It really is fascinating. So, you know, as you were saying, you know, this is management of a long-term condition. And I am mindful that people might be listening who might not accept that way of looking at it. But I think as well, if you are listening and you don't think that obesity is a chronic disease, that's all right as well. You know, I think like other viewpoints are okay, but you can still listen along and take some, you know, information from the discussion.
I think, you know, everybody is entitled to their opinions.
Yeah.
I suppose I feel very safe in that my opinions are based on the best medical and scientific evidence.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, that evidence is not well put out there. Certainly, I don't know about you, I didn't learn it in medical school.
No,
I didn't learn it in my GP training. It was only when I went to Canada and worked in a different environment that I was exposed to this.
Yeah.
And again, it was this, it was like a eureka moment of how have I not heard about this? How did I not know how our body regulates weight? This seems like a quite an important thing in society. If we think that, you know, maybe up to 60% of the Irish population are living with overweight or obesity, that maybe up to 1 in 4 of my patients are living with obesity.
Yeah.
How do we not kind of put more focus on this? How are we not kind of, you know, educating medical students? And also, you know, by educating people, by making people aware of the complexity of it, again, we should be reducing the blame and shame and stigma.
Yeah.
So again, you know, certainly in general practice training, we do a lot of work on kind of bias and identifying our own bias, whether it's intrinsic bias or extrinsic bias, and not kind of, you know, projecting kind of our biases onto patients.
Yes, yes.
So again, I suppose traditionally, let's say if somebody was living with HIV, you know, you wouldn't, you know, donkeys years ago, they talked about the AIDS patient.
Mm.
Like, we wouldn't say that now because that is utterly stigmatizing.
Yes.
We talk about somebody living with HIV because we know, again, we don't stigmatize and blame. And in the same way, we shouldn't talk about an obese person. It doesn't define them. It's not the only important thing.
Yes.
We should use person first language, which again is somebody living with obesity, somebody having obesity, because again, that it doesn't define them. You know, we don't talk about a cancerous person. We don't talk about a demented person. So why are we talking about an obese person?
Yes.
So this is a medical issue. We should use the right language. And to that point, actually, just, you know, across society, different words and different language is more or less acceptable to different people.
Mm.
You know, certainly in my practice, I can't abide the word fat.
Mm.
But many patients will use that to me. And sometimes they'll use it in a negative kind of way against themselves.
Yeah.
But there is a movement that is reclaiming the word fat.
Yes.
That this is how I identify is fat is a word for me.
Yeah.
Many people don't like the word obesity. They find it, again, stigmatizing.
Yeah.
And that's why I talk about the chronic disease of obesity rather than just obesity. Because, again, that word is not acceptable to many people.
Yes.
We talk about excess weight or unhealthy weight. There's many different ways. So it's quite important that we're sensitive to the language that people identify with.
That's a really nice point. So I think, you know, if somebody is listening to this, but there are words or terms or ideas that people are uncomfortable with, you know, you can actually just say that to your GP or your doctor, you know, say, actually, don't like that word. I prefer this instead, you know, and I think most GPs and doctors will go with you on that.
And to that point, again, a lot of the work that I do is kind of trying to educate people around these areas and GPs at the moment are crying out for education and talks and kind of, you know, they want more knowledge, particularly with the medications and different options. And again, it's educating people that, you know, if we want to bring up weight in general practice, we should ask permission. Because it's quite a sensitive area. You need to, again, that's putting the person at the centre. You know, ask permission. Listen, do you mind if I ask about your weight?
Yes.
You know, do you feel that your weight is affecting you? And if somebody says no, that's perfectly acceptable because they may not be in a place to talk about it. It may not be appropriate at that time.
Yeah.
Again, if for a medical reason we feel it's important to check weight, we should ask permission.
Yes.
We shouldn't just assume that it's okay for somebody to check their weight.
Absolutely.
Because that may have a profound impact on them.
Yes.
Maybe somebody doesn't check their weight for specific reasons, you know.
Yeah.
And again, you know, to me, I'm not very weight-centric at all. As in my clinic, I don't weigh people. I work in an obesity clinic. And I don't weigh people because that's not the marker for me.
Yes. Yeah, I do. As I said, I have a few patients on this and, you know, by no means are, you know, we doing weigh-ins or check-ins or anything like that. And if a patient wants to be weighed in the office, they can go for it. But, you know, some people want their weight checked
because they want to kind of to see is there a difference. Yeah. So again, it's just about, I think when the numbers on the scales are changing and coming down, people are often very happy.
Yes.
The problem is, what if we see a number we don't like? What if our weight is plateauing? What if it's going back up? Like, how is that going to affect us? So again, you know, I'm not, again, I'm agnostic about lots of different things.
Yeah.
So if somebody is interested and wants to check the weight, absolutely. I'm there to facilitate that. But it wouldn't be my kind of goal. If we kind of go back to kind of treating people with the medications, which is probably the mainstay of what I do with a lot of people, you know, as follow up, I'll ask them, you know, how is hunger? How is fullness? How are cravings? You know, what are eating patterns like at the moment? Are you able to eat and enjoy food? Because that's very important.
Yeah.
I think I would kind of surmise it in kind of, you know, does this feel like you're on a diet?
Okay.
And that's the big thing, because people say, no, it doesn't feel like I'm on a diet. I say, why doesn't it? Because I'm not restricting and denying myself. It's not the smart guy saying no, no, no all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's the caveman. And in my head, it's always a caveman, not a cave person. But it's the caveman just doesn't want it.
Yeah.
But I'm not as interested or as driven.
Mm.
And this is kind of, again, huge to people that this is their experience. And we've done that with a medication that treats the brain.
Yeah.
So again, you know, going back to there's many different ways of gauging response.
Yeah.
And again, we don't talk about success because the opposite of success is failure.
Yeah.
You know, so this is response. You know, somebody doesn't have success with chemotherapy. They have response.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody doesn't respond to a treatment, they're not doing anything wrong. It's that, you know, no person has ever failed a treatment. The treatment fails the person.
Mm.
So if somebody's not responding, it's because their biology is not being addressed.
Yeah.
And I suppose with these medications, those are some of the challenges.
Yeah.
Not every person will respond.
Yes.
And I think, you know, really, I think, again, you can probably tell from this, I do a lot of talking and I kind of talk through these things every day. But I think it's really important that people go into these kind of treatments with realistic expectations of what to expect on the positive and negative side. So in practice, we probably see 50% of people have a really good response to GLP-1 medications. 50% of people don't respond as well.
Okay.
And we are utterly useless at predicting who's going to respond.
So when you say really good, is that 10 to 20% weight loss? What is that?
So I suppose with the currently available medications, if we exclude people who kind of haven't responded and just look at the responders, we're probably seeing about a 10 to 15% body weight change.
Okay.
Now, again, that's again going against that. That's as one marker of response, ignoring all the other kind of responses we're looking for. But on average, that's what has been shown in the studies.
Okay.
With the currently available medication.
You said it about 9 months.
So most people, some people will lose weight faster and then plateau very quickly. Other people, it'll be more gradual. But most people kind of at 9 to 12 months, they will have plateaued.
And is that at like, say, the maximum dose of, say, commonly, you know, semaglutide? So Wegovy is the one that is for weight loss that we don't actually have available. It's 2.4 milligrams?
So with semaglutide as Ozempic, the diabetes medication, starts off at 0.25 milligrams once a week for month, then we go to 0.5 milligrams once a week for a month, and then 1 milligram once a week for a month. 1 milligram of Ozempic or 1 milligram semaglutide is the highest dose currently available. When Wegovy becomes available, probably in about 6 months from now, we're hoping, that will go to 1.7 and 2.4 milligrams. So exact same medication, just at a higher dose. The titration will be the same. The increase will be the same month on month, but it will have the option to go to 1.7 and 2.4. Some people will not need those doses, whereas some people will, because everybody responds differently. And it's not about, you know, ramping people up to the highest dose to get their weight as low as possible. It is about kind of facilitating kind of, you know, changes that improve their health.
Yeah.
If we talk about in the studies at the 2.4 milligrams of the semaglutide, probably 15 to 20% body weight change is what we see in the responders.
Yes.
So this is why, like, again, this is an exceptionally exciting time for me as a weight management specialist, is that we now have medications that are achieving kind of levels of weight change that are majorly improving health, but also kind of almost starting to rival some of the treatments like bariatric surgery.
Yes.
I still stand over bariatric surgery is still the most effective treatment we have for many people. But again, even if you look at bariatric surgery, some people may lose 15% of their body weight. Some people may lose 35% of their body weight. Again, for many different reasons, because everybody responds differently. So hopefully when Wegovy becomes available in about 6 months' time, we'll be seeing kind of 15 to 20% body weight change.
Okay.
And then on the horizon, we have more medications. There's a medication called tirzepatide. And if anybody has the misfortune of being on TikTok, which I'm not brave enough to go near that. But if anybody's out, they'll see the names that people recognize the names. Yeah, of these. Yeah. So tirzepatide or Mounjaro, which is kind of, I don't know where they come up with the names for these medications. But that is a medication that's being used for diabetes in the States.
Yes.
In the States, it's not licensed for weight management or obesity. It's being used off license there. And people are seeing kind of 22% body weight change.
Yeah.
So kind of more. And then there are more medications. There's another one called cagrilinotide with semaglutide, a combination medication that's coming again probably in a year or 18 months. And we're probably seeing, higher levels of maybe up to 25% body weight change.
Yeah.
They're developing monthly injectable medications. So the landscape is going to change. And I really liken this to when we started treating blood pressure, we had very limited medications and we saw some response and people's health improved. But now we have many different tools in our shed to treat this. So at the moment, when the only tool you have is a hammer fixes all problems.
Yes.
And the biggest and best hammer we have is probably semaglutide.
Yeah.
The problem is that's off label, off license in its current form. So many healthcare practitioners are not comfortable prescribing a medication for something it's not marketed for or produced for. And again, that has kind of connotations. So when the newer medications become available that are licensed and indicated, there may be more comfort with prescribing those.
Okay. Yeah.
But again, until they are reimbursed, until they're covered, until people can access them, it's a major issue. And the other challenge we're having at the moment is shortages.
Yes.
There's huge shortages of these medications. Because I think the companies, when they produced them, they didn't anticipate that there would be this much demand.
Mm.
We've used these medications for many, many years for diabetes, and they've worked really well for that. And that's what they're still used for. But now this is a new reason why people are using them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's creating a lot of challenges, the availability of these medications.
Yeah, I saw recently on TikTok that they are really cracking down on the off-license prescribing of Mounjaro because there's not enough of it available. Mm. And then I see there are some people that are critical of doctors that are prescribing Ozempic, so that's traditionally licensed for the treatment of diabetes, but not for weight loss. But then some doctors are prescribing it for weight management, and then some people are criticizing doctors, saying that we are diverting medication away from people with diabetes. What do you think about that?
Lots of thoughts on that.
Yeah.
So basically, the way it's been kind of put out there, I think in kind of media or in social media, is kind of pitting two groups against each other: people with diabetes versus people with obesity.
Yeah.
And the stigma and bias and discrimination that exists in society and online and in media against obesity has shifted the conversation to, Hollywood's elite are taking these medications because they're lazy and they don't want to do the hard work to lose weight, whereas these people who are living with diabetes don't have medication that's life-saving.
Yeah.
That's the narrative that's out there.
Yeah.
And to me, that's a false narrative. And it's very stigmatizing. It is every bit as valid for somebody living with the chronic disease of obesity to receive treatment as somebody living with diabetes.
Yeah.
One of these diseases is not more important than the other. Somebody who's living with obesity, it's not their fault they have this disease, this medical condition. They're living with it and they're trying to manage it. They should be able to access safe, effective treatments. It's also not that person's fault that they have the disease. They should be applauded for seeking treatment and kind of engaging on treatment.
Yeah.
And then we're putting more roadblocks in their way. So they shouldn't be blamed and shamed. They shouldn't be blamed for shortages. It's not their fault that the pharma companies didn't produce enough of these medications and now they're trying to catch up.
Yeah.
If we say, diabetes is absolutely a complex disease. When somebody is using these medications for diabetes, it will improve their blood sugars. There are other medications that can be used for diabetes as well. Unfortunately for obesity, we have a limited number of medications that work.
Yeah.
So again, pitting people against each other is not fair. Saying that diabetes is more important than obesity is not fair.
Mm.
Obesity affects people's life and their health, and they deserve treatment. We shouldn't be blaming the people who are living with this disease.
Mm.
As far as certainly there was a circular or kind of a release put out to GPs, again, to your point, telling them not to prescribe these medications.
Yeah.
But again, for me, it's kind of mystifying. When a patient comes into me as a GP, given that person's experience of life, the bravery, the amount of courage, the fear that's accompanied with coming and asking for treatment, or asking for help.
Yeah.
The last thing we should be doing is knocking these people away or kind of giving out to them. Because again, these people have been discriminated against, you know, for so long. Just told, listen, go off and eat less and move more, as if it was that easy.
Yeah.
So again, we should be encouraging people to kind of seek treatment. The challenge is, you know, treating people the right way.
Yes.
And again, you know, one of the other challenges that I have seen emerging is there are prescription services out there where maybe people can access a prescription.
Yeah. So this is when you just type in a bunch of details online and then you tell the computer your details, and then the computer spits out a prescription and then you go and fill it out.
And you would presume that there is oversight from a doctor somewhere. But for me, again, you know, if I'm seeing somebody for a first visit and we're spending 40 minutes together and we're chatting, we're going through their history, we're going through their experience, we're going through the impact that weight has on their life. We're talking about treatment options, all the treatment options. We're talking about, you know, reasons why they may not be able to take certain treatments. We're talking about side effects. We're talking about the fact this needs to be used long term. And also we're talking about, you know, maybe it's not appropriate for some people to take these medication. And really, you know, I do see some people who are not living with the chronic disease of obesity. You know, so really, I suppose there's a difference between somebody with the chronic disease of obesity versus somebody who wants to be thin. And this kind of cultural desire for thinness.
Yeah.
And that's not who we're treating. We're not treating people who want to be thin. We're treating people who've got a medical issue. Because again, the person who, let's say, just wants to be thin for whatever reasons, when they stop the medication, the weight will come back.
Is it being abused? Is that happening?
So there is a danger of that happening. And again, if people are accessing this, you know, from abroad, some people are getting it posted to them. Some people are accessing it kind of through Facebook groups and different things. Like, it terrifies me. These are medications that people need to go in educated. People are smart. They need to make kind of appropriate decisions. But you can see why people are doing this, because they're desperate for treatment. And they don't know where to access treatment. But we need the understanding. We need the explanation. We need to kind of frame, you know, what is going to happen with this medication. If somebody, you know, expects that they're going to lose 30 or 40% of their body weight with this medication, they might be the unicorn for whom that happens, but the statistical evidence would tell us that's unlikely. So if that's their expectation, you know, even if they have a response and improvement in health, they may be disappointed. They may feel they've done something wrong. They may stop taking the medication, you know, as a result. So again, I think information is vital. The problem is there's so much information out there that is bombarding people. People don't know where to go for the right information.
And all of that information is being put out there at a population level. So really, it's so important, again, to bring it back to like your own person-centered care and, you know, go to somebody like yourself or go to your GP. You can talk to your GP about it as well. Because all of that information, it's too overwhelming. And it can be really distilled down to, you know, a much easier, like, you know, information that can be a lot easier for you to just live your life. Okay, so let me see. I think we'll just do a quick fire round of just some, and we'll just try to go through them kind of quickly. Okay, when will WeGo be available in Ireland? Do we know?
We don't know for sure, but we're hoping in about 6 months.
Okay, is there any chance of any of these medicines becoming available on the medical card or the drug payment scheme?
There is a hope that Saxenda, liraglutide, the daily injectable medication, will be reimbursed under medical card and drug payment scheme.
Really?
But it's going to be restricted in who can access it. So there's going to be very kind of clear restrictions that it will be under certain kind of controlled circumstances. If somebody's weight is above a certain level, or their BMI, to go back to that indicator, that's what they're still basing it on.
Okay.
And if they're living with certain medical conditions, then some people will be able to access it.
Okay.
But it will require kind of authorization and different things. So
there
is a hope, but not to the level that I want to see it reimbursed.
Okay. But nice to see some movement towards reimbursing. That's good. And then one of the questions I was going to ask you is it safe to buy it online? And really it isn't. And actually, I don't like any medicines really being kind of bought online or on a prescription service. I don't really like that idea.
And I think, you know, for me, and again, maybe it's my own ego, but I think when people come and see us, part of it is sharing that understanding, is sharing that information, that knowledge with people, that's the, to me, the most important part of the consultation. It's not whether somebody goes on a medication or not, because that makes no difference to me. That might make a difference to them, but it's kind of having that understanding, people going in with their eyes open. People are smart. They make kind of decisions about their own health and they decide what they're going to do when they have the right information.
Totally.
So people getting it online, you know, again, if it's posted them, the medication is supposed to be refrigerated before they get it. Has there been kind of proper discussion about kind of medical reasons why they may not be able to take it? If somebody has a history of pancreatitis in the past, then we don't give the medication. If somebody themselves and their family has a history of a rare type of thyroid cancer called medullary thyroid cancer, we don't give this medication.
Yes.
If somebody has gallstones, we're very cautious because it could aggravate gallstones, knowing that somewhere between 1 in 3 per 1,000 people on this medication may get pancreatitis. About 1 in 100 people on this medication may develop symptoms of gallstones. Knowing that kind of many people, when they go on the medication, you know, this is not magic beans that we're selling, that this is a medication and there are side effects and there are issues and they may not respond. We know that many people, when they go on it, nausea is probably the most significant side effect that people encounter. It tends to be, thankfully, kind of transient and temporary when people start, and it usually settles. But some people get a more profound response. And probably 1 in 20 people, this medication isn't for them because of side effects.
Yes.
We know heartburn can be an issue for many people, constipation. Some people get these kind of eggy sulfur burps as well, which can be kind of very challenging. And then rarely, sometimes we see diarrhea with it as well. So again, there are kind of side effects to the medication too. And then discussing the cost and the fact that this is a long-term treatment. You know, again, all these things kind of need to be gone through.
They do. And also you need somebody to turn to, and you need to have a doctor to ask advice for if you are starting to experience side effects. So if somebody is getting abdominal pain, you know, they need to be able to see their doctor, you know, and say, look, I think I'm getting a side effect
and
of this medication.
For many people, if somebody gets kind of more severe nausea, sometimes we'll reduce the dose. Sometimes we will use kind of different patterns of eating. So by taking small amounts, often people tend to do better. By prioritizing protein and fiber, by keeping away from processed foods, people tend to feel better and get less side effects. And also, I suppose the other important factor would be these medications are not to be used when somebody is pregnant or breastfeeding. So if somebody is potentially, I don't want to say at risk of getting pregnant, but if somebody is potentially could become pregnant, they need to use contraception or some method to stop pregnancy. If somebody is planning on a pregnancy, then these medications need to be stopped in advance. So again, depending on which medication, and I think, you know, again, the Saxenda, the daily injectable medication, which is a fantastic medication, works really well as well. The effectiveness of the Saxenda is probably similar to the Ozempic 1 milligram. The challenge is it's injecting every day and it's more expensive. But it is licensed and indicated, and a lot of doctors may be more comfortable prescribing that medication compared to the off-licensed medication. But again, these medications, they need to be stopped before trying for pregnancy, and they shouldn't be used when breastfeeding. So the idea would be somebody would probably be off them if they're looking to become pregnant, if they get pregnant and breastfeed. Then after that, then they may restart the medication.
Yes.
So again, these are kind of important kind of conversations that people are aware of this stuff.
Totally. I mean, prescription medications are serious business, really. So you have to have a doctor or, you know, GP as backup. So I just want to ask, okay, two more questions. So one, and you did allude to it about this being a lifelong medication. And for me, I'm very comfortable with that. Obviously, as a GP and a doctor, I think lifelong management and repeat prescriptions, that makes sense to me. But when I have mentioned these, the GLP-1 agonist medications online, and one of the main questions I'm asked, actually, which I didn't anticipate, was, like, does it have to be lifelong? If I, you know, if I just take it for a while and then I achieve my, or I reach my best weight. Sorry, I need to get better. I need to get rid of normal and achieve. That was okay. So if I reach my best weight.
Yeah, perfect.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Or I'm at my best weight, and then I really want to stop these. Is there a cohort of patients that can stop them, or how does it? Is it most typically a lifelong medication?
So I suppose the way, because again, these are, I get very similar questions every day. And what I would say to people is that treatment is lifelong. Whether it's this treatment or another treatment is lifelong. because this chronic disease is not going to magically disappear. Mm. It's not going to be cured. We manage it. So my expectation would be based on the scientific evidence that when we treat somebody, they can will reach their best weight. If we stop the treatment, the symptoms come back. And my expectation is that for the vast majority of people, that weight will come back as well.
Mm.
Despite our best efforts to maintain kind of eating patterns and physical activity. Now, again, we don't know whether it come back very slowly or very quickly.
Yes.
It's going to be different for everybody.
Yeah.
And again, you know, all we can do is educate people on what we expect to happen.
Yeah.
I'm well aware that there are some people who will stop these medications, but as long as I feel my role is to inform them that this is what's going to happen. They may feel, or they will feel, hunger coming back. They will feel less satisfied by food. They will see more cravings. Their weight is not going to shoot up kind of, you know, way above where it was before. Essentially, they're going to rejoin the trajectory they were on.
Okay.
So their weight will go back up and they will gain weight kind of at the rate they may have been before, if that's if that was what their pattern was.
Yeah.
And that would be my expectation. So again, you know, the best treatment for somebody today may not be the best treatment in a year, 5 years, 10 years. Some people may go on these medications. They may have a very good response to the medication. But say, I don't want to take this forever.
Mm-hmm.
I want to look at a surgical treatment long term.
Yes.
Say,
okay.
Brilliant. That's great.
Yes.
Because that's sensible.
Yeah.
You know, we may get a better medication in 6 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years. We have a monthly injection or something else. And people may transition or move to that. Or maybe kind of somebody is kind of plateaued, and then over time, for some reason, they're struggling more. They may need intensivization, or maybe where their weight reaches isn't where they need to be for health reasons.
Mm.
So maybe we need to look at a stronger medication or combining medications.
Yeah.
You know, again, and we're very focused on the medications, but equally, you know, if somebody's on these medications, they will likely benefit from kind of additional behavioral or nutritional or kind of life interventions as well, to really kind of facilitate, you know, that improvement in health and you know, sustainability long term. So people need long term treatment. Treatment options are going to change. We will have even more effective medications. These medications are very safe. We will have less side effects from medications in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Very smart people are working on coming up with kind of, you know, fantastic new treatments, surgical treatments, endoscopic treatments, medication treatments. Mm-hmm. That work for people. And the more options we have for people, the better.
Yeah.
Because again, what's acceptable to one person, you know, may not be acceptable to another.
Totally. And as well, I think, you know, the way I think of it, I think of it like managing any other lifelong condition. You know, it's not a failing or a failure, you know, to be on a medication long term, to manage a condition long term.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting because I think traditionally, and you'll probably kind of remember back in GP training, we often have these kind of modules on breaking bad news.
Mm.
That we're kind of telling somebody, I'm very sorry, you have a medical condition, you have a disease. And it's breaking bad news, and how we do that in an appropriate way, and how we give people time to kind of take it in, and how we're kind of, you know, sensitive in how we do it. When I'm telling somebody who's living with obesity that they have a chronic disease, it's almost like breaking good news. Because that person, you're telling them they have a medical issue, which is crap. Like, I'm sorry that you're living with this medical issue. But it explains why their lived experience has been how it has been because of their biology. It helps them understand why this isn't their fault, why this isn't motivation and lack of willpower, why this is much more complex. So they're kind of saying, you know, okay, well, I don't want to have a medical problem. But equally, this helps me understand why this isn't a failure on my part, you know. And the challenge is then that kind of, you know, different people respond to treatments differently. So we don't have the best treatment for everybody yet, but we're working on it. And the only way we know if somebody's going to respond is to try it.
Give it a
you
try.
Know, if it's acceptable to them. And as I said, that goes back to, you know, this is not, you know, me walking down the street, grabbing people saying, here, try this medication.
Yeah.
It's a case of, you know, there are many people who this is not right for them. And we shouldn't be trying to impose this on people.
Mm.
It should be very much more what is important to you in your life and in your health. And then giving people access if they want to access it.
Totally. Really important point. And I hope that is kind of implied or obvious throughout this conversation. This isn't about imposing anything on anyone. It's just giving information, and you know, if there is anybody who feels like it is for them, that you know, that they feel like they can approach you or their GP. So on that note then, to get a consultation with you or your team, because you have a team at My Best Weight, so how do people do that? So to check you out on Instagram?
So we're on Instagram, we're on Twitter, our website mybestweight.ie. People can, people don't need a referral, they can come to us through the website. Because certainly as a GP, I know I used to hate writing letters.
Letters. No referral needed.
It used to take half my day was writing letters to doctors.
If
somebody can refer themselves, it's kind of so. I was very mindful of the GPs of the country.
I feel like I've no homework now.
Exactly. So mybestweight.ie, they can come at us through that. And again, like I say, for some people, this is a conversation. It's not necessarily kind of a treatment. And I suppose I'm lucky now that we have the kind of medical treatments. We have an exercise physiologist who focuses on movement and health. We have a nutritional and behavioural specialist who focuses on those areas. And again, people can engage in whichever kind of treatment they feel is right for them. Or none. Sometimes it's just information gathering or sharing. And then in general, if people are open to it, I'll usually communicate back with their GP just about what we're doing, just to make sure that everybody is aware of what medications are on, to try and do it in the safest way possible.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Vic. That was brilliant. Is there anything else we need to add, or anything else you'd like to say, or anything else we missed?
No, I think I'm just really thankful that these conversations have been had, because one of the most frustrating things, I talk to people every day about this. And obviously this is my... excites me, this gets me going. I think I'm really passionate about this. And people are mystified as to how and why they've never heard about this science and this evidence before. So the more we can kind of inform people of this and educate healthcare professionals and politicians and everybody that kind of, you know, this is kind of treatment, it doesn't remove the need for us to also focus on policies around advertising of food and children, about nutritional literacy, about physical activity, you know, that primary prevention element. You know, it doesn't remove that, but it just means that if somebody has a medical issue, they should be able to access treatment in the same way as they access treatment for depression or blood pressure or diabetes. And you know, the old fashioned, you know, all you need to do is eat less and move more. Unfortunately, it doesn't work because it's not that simple. You know, telling somebody with obesity to eat less and move more is like telling somebody with depression to cheer up.
Or with a broken bone, you know, to just get up and walk.
Exactly. So it doesn't work. So I'm really grateful for you for having these conversations and putting the information out there.
No, thank you so much. It was lovely to chat, Vic. Thank you so much for listening today. I really hope you enjoyed the episode. This episode was sponsored by Supplements Made Simple.